content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Happy Thanksgiving. Today, I will read two Thanksgiving-related articles from the archives of the New Yorker magazine. I'll start with a short story from the fiction section of the June 9th and 16, 2014 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Here's the story by David Gilbert. It ends with his right hand gripping her left, the curve of her knuckles, the pulling yoke. The plane is on its final approach. Greater Cincinnati lies ahead. Outside, it's dark, snowing lightly. Every window seems to have concluded its broadcast day, though in houses down below, people idle in front of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Lucy Show. Whatever might happen above is not their concern. The landing gear is set, and 2 miles the runway, flaps 50. Altimeters cross-checked on 07. Inside the cabin, he squeezes her hand harder. The flight manifest lists them as Theodore Harris Martin, seat 9B, and Emma Callahan Brady, seat 6A, both from Los Angeles, specifically Studio City. The date is November 20th, and the year is 1967, and the time is 8:57 p.m. It's a Monday. In 3 days, it will be Thanksgiving. That is what we know. We also know that 7 weeks earlier, the Los Angeles Dodgers played their final game of the season at home against the New York Mets. It was a Sunday afternoon, October 1st. The weather was warm, the sky cloudless, a perfect day for baseball, Vin Scully proclaimed to his radio audience. The stadium was half full, which even the most optimistic fan looking around would consider almost empty. No surprise, it was a meaningless game. A year ago, these Dodgers had been in the World Series, but now, without Koufax, they were third from last being these lowly Mets. The players seemed embarrassed to be there, like men pretending to be boys pretending to be men. Only Don Drysdale appeared at ease. The Big D signed autographs during batting practice, his veteran smile holding forth on reminiscences of broken-down buses and second-rate hotels. Hours spent packed in ice. All those hero-to-bum ratios. Ted Martin, 35, stood near the third base rail, sheepish among the children, his left arm reaching forward, in his hand a baseball. He and Don shared a Van Nuys pedigree, only a few grades separating them in high school. Though Don would retire soon, while Ted would remain a lawyer with fugitive dreams. You can't pin all your hopes on just one thing. That's what Ted's wife said. You need options, like an actual career. Then again, Carol was a practical woman who distrusted too much encouragement, except when it came to her singing in church. Here you go, kid. Drysdale placed the baseball back into Ted's hand, and Ted wondered if kid was tongue-in-cheek, a jab between middle-aged men, or merely a function of the bottom line. Pupils focused on the end game of ink. Were we all kids here? Ted lingered for a moment in the chorus before returning to his seat, and as he climbed toward his row, he found himself wavering between feeling very young and feeling very old. His plan was to lord the baseball over his daughters, evidence of what they had missed, contact with a bona fide all-star, a future Hall of Famer, Don Drysdale in the flesh. Yesterday, the girls had begged him to let them skip the game. Please, 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 Dad, so they could work on some Sunflower Girl project, and Ted had given in and last minute had to corral other people, which reminded him of his limited supply of friends. All of them busy today, the seats starting to signify a greater failure, until Renshaw from the office said, yeah, sure, and asked if he could bring his 12-year-old son, Renshaw Jr., the two of them visible up ahead. Hot dog guy came, Renshaw said. Peanuts too, Renshaw Jr. added. This information was self-evident and rather explicit on their faces. Ted stood there, delaying the knee-to-knee proximity. Over the stadium PA, I'm a believer, played as a message for the fans next year. Ted's oldest daughter, loved Davy Jones. He could hear her shriek in his head. "You get anyone?" Renshaw asked. Ted showed him the ball, as if it had been baptized and now possessed a soul. "Who's that?" "Drysdale." Renshaw nudged Renshaw Jr. This father and son combo reminded Ted of those before and after panels glimpsed in magazines. In this case, advertising the effects of adolescence, of alcohol and age, of a 100-pound weakling swelling into a thick, vindictive bully, which gave Ted brief guilt since he had been the golden boy in high school, with enviable skin and a natural physique, a poor representative of the awkward teenage years. And all for what, he wondered? To grow up and play the role of lawyer, like Robert Redford, another Van Nuys graduate, except his character in Barefoot in the Park married a free spirit and lived in New York City, in Greenwich Village, no less, and there was no church, and there were no daughters, and no Fluffy the goddamn cat. There was only sex. Sex in the most innocent and lovely of misunderstandings. "You should go," Renshaw said to Renshaw Jr. "Huh? Go and get Drysdale's autograph." Renshaw Jr. stopped chewing his peanuts. "Got no pen," he said. "Drysdale will have a pen." "And got," he swallowed, "nothing for him to sign." "Use your program, nitwit." Disarmed of excuses, Renshaw Jr. began clearing his lap of half-eaten food. No easy chore, and in the process knocked from his knee a box of popcorn that tumbled to the ground and shattered into its affiliated parts. The boy froze, perhaps hoping that this pose might suspend the ramifications of the spill. "Jesus Christ," Renshaw said. "You would have thought a prize vase had been broken." Renshaw turned to Ted. "Count yourself lucky you only have girls." "Well," Ted started, "no, believe me, brainless doesn't begin to do him justice." The boy glanced up from the mess, his hand still maintaining the spiritual weight of what was lost. Ted had no desire to witness any further humiliations en route to Drysdale, so he hitched deliverance to a smile, in the mode of athletes and actors who squint at the light that glows from within. In this case, of Ted Martin, benevolent adult. "Here you go, kid." And with that, he tossed the baseball, well advertised in advance, something his middle daughter could have caught, and she was easily the least coordinated of his girls. But maybe the sun was in Renshaw Jr.'s eyes, or he was distracted by the fallen popcorn. Either way, the ball slipped through his hands, hit the concrete, and rolled into the gutter under the seats in front of them. Renshaw Jr. panicked, practically upending himself in the retrieval. "Hopeless," Renshaw said. Around noon that day, people raised their hands in nearby Elysian Park and sought the return of the Great Spirit. It was the second love-in of the year, an unofficial follow-up to the first, which had been held on Easter, and was still talked about in certain tuned-in circles. At least 4,000 people had attended, a beautiful gathering of the tribes, and the diggers had really outdone themselves with the food, and particularly those psychedelic watermelons. The Flamin' Groovies had played, as had the Peanut Butter Conspiracy and the Rainy Days and a few other bands only half remembered. Oh, and Barry McGuire had made an appearance, dressed as Adam, and someone later spotted him destroying some Eve under a Navajo blanket. It had been a magical day, though the Los Angeles Times had dubbed it a camp out of the camp, a rejoicing of the rejected. This time around, there was no reporter on the scene, and there was no formal stage, no Chet Helms giving his blessing on behalf of the humans of the hate. This Sunday, roughly 1,000 people came together in the hope of recreating the past. And, as with many copies, the sharpness was blurred around the edges, its unique and special vibe desaturated, giving the proceedings an aura of forced joyfulness. Every smile insisted on another smile in return. Not that Emma Brady, 33, noticed. She stood on the periphery and smiled, because this was all new to her, this roller coaster ride of people. "Hello," she said, whenever someone dipped into her line of sight, unsure if she really belonged there. Was she the sacrificial square? The parental mirror? Emma was only 15. 10, maybe as little as 5 years older than most of the assembled crowd, yet they all seemed so young compared with her state of affairs. More than a decade married, the mother of three boys, the youngest 6 years old, by her side. "What are they doing, Mommy?" he asked. "Praying, I think." "To God?" "Well, to a God." Bobby thought about this and then said, "Like Sandy Koufax?" "No, more like Pete Rose," Emma teased, since she was a Cincinnati Reds fan while the men under her roof bled Dodger blue. This weekend, the older boys and her husband were camping at Lake Casitas, and there had been pressure for her to go, to have the whole family together. "Come on, Em, we'll fish and canoe and have a grand old time," or so her husband had said. "Please, join us." "No, honey, not today, not this weekend, sorry." She was exhausted and in no mood to act as a pioneer woman in gingham and kerchief. "Two nights, that's all, honey." Just like Mike, to keep pushing, to treat her like the sullen daughter who was being difficult for the sake of being difficult. His enthusiasm always had the quality of a concealed weapon. And, of course, little Bobby had insisted on staying with her, his brown eyes like rising water, and she his only means of escape. And this had really rocked Mike, though he would save the outburst for easier game, like the boys, or the dog. Poor Tiger bore much residual blame. "Who are they?" Bobby asked. "Hippies, or most of them," Emma said, though she could see other curious tourists like herself who had waded into this patchwork of suede and macrame, beads, and exposed skin. The drums grew louder, and a more unified om vibrated the air. There was a main circle of people, a handful of committed participants at its center, many of them dancing with some kind of prop, while others gestured in ways that seemed to reference a greater mystical force. An array of musical instruments joined the fray, not necessarily in order or in tune, a guitar, a tambourine, a flute, and a violin, their harmony squirming through the narrowest of openings. "This is weird," Bobby said. Outside the main circle, smaller circles turned like human-sized gears. "Yeah," Emma agreed, and she wondered if this was like Easter. "On Easter, of all days," Mike had complained when he saw the coverage on the local news. "Who are these people to do this on Easter? I'm trying very hard to understand." He certainly hadn't looked to Emma for an explanation. A large man in a tuxedo and a top hat wandered by holding a dozen yellow balloons, each stenciled with the word love, the sentiment seeming in opposition to his face, which was painted a ghoulish white. He spotted Bobby and stopped. "You want a balloon?" Emma wondered if he was a struggling actor, an unemployed mime. Were all these people out-of-work artists? "Sure," Bobby said. The man handed him one. "Well, what are you going to give me in return?" Emma reached for her pocketbook. "No money, ma'am," the man said. "Something else. An exchange of goods." "Well, I don't think I have anything that you would want," Emma tried to explain. "Sorry," the man said. "I'm talking to the boy." Bobby patted his pockets, produced a rabbit's foot. "Well, I've got this." The man raised the fur toward the sun. "Is it lucky?" he asked. "Never done me any good." Before this remark could fully sink in, of her son and his feelings of doom, of being jinxed, of always losing stuff and getting injured, of being too short, too dumb, totally talentless compared to his popular older brothers, and his father no help either. "Stop moping around." Before Emma could glimpse her own self-doubt in those words, the man in the tuxedo and top hat had handed Bobby two more balloons. "Here's your change," he said. Frisella was pitching for the Mets, Foster for the Dodgers, and after six innings, New York was winning 1-0, with Mook scoring in the second on Bosch's base hit to left. L.A. had managed only 5 scattered singles and was looking listless in the field. The diamond might as well have been a classroom clock on the last day of school. Ted maintained an orderly box score, something his father had taught him to do when they went to see the old Hollywood Stars at Gilmore Field, back when the Pacific Coast League was the only game in town. He enjoyed transcribing the action into the shorthand of LOBs and IBBs, the forward or backward K, the almost algebraic equations of SAC8 and F9 and DP163. Here, human position was expressed in pencil, fate as a form of filling in the blanks, FC46. "What are you doing?" Renshaw Jr. asked. The boy had recovered the ball, his sweaty palms rendering Drysdale's signature a blur. "Keeping score," Ted said. "Well, that's more than just the score." "This is what's behind the score," Ted explained. "Like with the last inning, here's Davis and his fly ball to right, and Ferrara's single to center, and Roseboro, remember he had a pop fly to third, and then fairly grounded to first. It's all right here."
"Seems like homework," Renshaw Jr. said.
"Not really. It just keeps you involved," Ted said. "I like knowing what happened when Swoboda was last up. He grounded out, but before that he had a single, and maybe Foster will pitch him differently this inning. Maybe not. But I have that information right here, the whole story. It's like I'm a necessary witness." Renshaw snorted before finishing his fourth beer.
"What?"
Ted asked. "Can't we just watch the lousy game?" "Your boy was curious." "No, he was just asking a stupid question." "Well, I was giving him an answer."
"That wasn't an answer. That was, well, I don't know what the hell that was."
Ted heard a hint of his wife in the tone, an impatience that bordered on outright scorn, as though his brand of parenting interfered with the actual business of raising children. Carol constantly hovering nearby, an impresario reminding him to wrap things up, like at bedtime. Especially at bedtime, and his habit of tucking in the girls and reciting from memory The Children's Hour by Longfellow. "From my study I see in the lamplight, descending the broad hall stair, grave Alice and laughing Allegra, and Edith with golden hair." Ted would insert his daughter's names and sort of perform the poem, and maybe it was a bit long and corny too, but it was something he enjoyed doing and something he thought the girls enjoyed hearing. And it was certainly better than the monkeys, and maybe they would remember a few stanzas and recall those moments with Dad and how he gave them a love for old-fashioned poetry, regardless of any mutterings that it was getting late and the girls needed their sleep. And instead of Longfellow, how about a nice haiku? Carol always paused after one of her clever lines, anticipating laughter from an audience, it seemed. Was he pedantic and sentimental? Was there a worse combination? Swoboda grounded to short. How would he score his own existence?
"Hey, necessary witness, you get that?" Renshaw cracked.
Ted gave him a middle finger grin. "I'm going to the bathroom," he said. "We shall try not to bear false witness in your absence." And then Renshaw cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted toward home,
"Mook, you stink!"
In Elysian Park, a growing line of people held hands and weaved through the crowd as fast as they could, the leader, the needle guiding the thread. Bobby was somewhere in the middle. It had been too tempting for him to let pass without joining, and he handed his mother the three balloons and jumped onto the end, holding this position briefly until others grabbed on and the line grew longer, its stitching more intricate. Emma watched from a distance. Every now and then, Bobby swung into view, and she smiled and waved, feeling glad to be here, the strangest of Sunday picnics. A group nearby smoked marijuana from a peace pipe, just as she imagined they would. And she wondered about LSD, having seen that recent Dragnet episode with the sugar cubes and the acid freaks, the crazed blue boy. Detective Sergeant Joe Friday gave her husband yet another reason for his strict parenting. "These stories are true, Emma. These are simply the facts." Mike could relate to Joe. After all, every father carries a kind of badge. And Emma just nodded along. But the people in Elysian Park seemed to be having a wonderful time. No bum trips in evidence, just a warm, flowing affection. She spotted Bobby again. They would have to keep this afternoon a secret. Once more she smiled and waved, and a palpable lightness came over her. Possibly thanks to the balloons and the roving psychedelia,
And even if this lightness could somehow lift her up from the ground and float her above the trees, no one around here would have noticed, or in noticing, would have thought anything peculiar. Ted had no desire to return to the Renshaws. Instead, he wandered around the concourse, thinking he should buy something for the girls. A pennant, maybe. But his mind was unable to commit to any purchase, and he soon found himself corkscrewing down the pedestrian ramp. The sensation of clandestine escape thrilled him, as though he had been called to action by a higher power. His wrist watch synced for some secret plan. Leave. Ted often thought about his destiny, about why he was here and for what purpose. To take out the trash, Carol would have cracked. And though there was a touch of narcissism in these meditations, a certain kind of hubris, in the end destiny seemed more like a gun pressed into his back, leading him to who knows where. Just walk, and no funny business. Sometimes he figured the only question was where he would drop. Right now, the snub-nosed barrel pushed him clear of Dodger Stadium and the Renshaws, and once outside prodded him away from his station wagon and toward Elysian Park. A single word hung in his head, avocados. He would bring avocados to the girls. Ted walked through the parking lot, quilted with cars, and then fewer cars, until finally the empty gray plain ended on an accumulation of hills and trees and grass. The tint was more sepia than green, as if nature were an old photograph in the city's scrapbook. An image of Ted's father arose, the times he had taken him into the park to watch the filming of another Ken Maynard Western, with the horseplay and the shooting. His dad had been an accountant for Republic Pictures, and afterward they hunted for avocados, Ted in charge of climbing ever higher, his father directing from below. Where else can you get free fruit in this town, he would say. 25 years later, Ted was back on the hunt. His shoes were all wrong for the task, the soles nothing but slip, and he grew winded from hiking the switchbacks to the top. He tried to remember where the avocado trees were, and when he finally found them, he struggled up the trunks in search of hidden fruit, it being late in the season. His wife hated avocados, something about the mushy texture reminding her of rotten flesh, as if she were on intimate terms with decay. And no doubt the girls would follow suit, but maybe he could show them the pleasures of the pit. How you could cut around the middle and twist, and the halves would come apart around a hard center, a world hidden within a world. Carol would roll her eyes here, and how you could remove the pit and poke in a few toothpicks and rest this Sputnik half submerged in a glass of water. And in a few weeks, you'd have the beginnings of a tree right there on the windowsill and someday avocados in the Martin backyard. This scenario played in Ted's imagination as he searched the picked over trees, dirtying his slacks and splitting a seam on his shirt. But on the fifth tree, he spotted a runt hanging high. Its existence, once noted, hijacking the scene, like a dangling grenade. It took some atavistic climbing for Ted to reach that gnarled and hardly worth the ever avocado. But he had it in his hand. It was ridiculous, but it was his. He paused for a moment, wedged between the branches, and from this peaceful vantage he could hear beating beyond the beating of his own heart, a beating of drums, like that of Indians of old, as if the fiddle and buckaroo were being shot in a nearby field. It was coming from over that hill, beyond that line of trees. Boom, boom, boom. Then Ted saw three balloons rising like a smoke signal, yellow balloons, neck and neck in the midday sky. And he thought of his daughters, though this thought was mostly buried, and what emerged was an unexpected feeling of sadness, watching those three balloons disappear, as if the earth had been let go from somebody's hand. "Where are the balloons?" Bobby asked when he returned. Emma had a sense that he would want to bring them home and show his brothers, and possibly brag about he and Mom had had a swell time without them. Went to Elysian Park, where there was a whole mess of people, some barely enclosed, like happies. "Happies? You mean hippies?" "Yeah, hippies. and they had chanted and played games, and he had traded his rabbit's foot for these balloons, and his father, probably still in that flannel shirt and cartoonish fishing hat, would buttress his hands against his waist and give Emma the look that seemed his birthright, a look she feared seeing in her own boys. Though, in fairness, Mike could also be loving and fun and certainly had a creative side. But so often that looseness snapped back into sanctimony, and the person she had loved without children, with children she loved less. He had become nothing but father. The balloons would require an explanation and would garner that look. And Emma was unsure how many more of those looks she could survive. "They just blew away," she told Bobby. "Oh." "A big breeze suddenly came and..." Emma opened her fingers as illustration. "Oh, I'm sorry." "It's okay," Bobby said, taking her hand. And this was what she always forgot, how Bobby made her failures his own. Instead of Ken Maynard riding his white stallion Tarzan, the field below offered up an otter scene, as if the police had gathered all the kids who loitered in West Hollywood and Venice Beach, the stragglers glimpsed from passing cars, who were sometimes in the news, as in the recent rumors of a hate Ashbury outbreak in Beverly Hills, and deposited them here, in these few acres, all the freaks of L.A. It resembled a seasonal convocation, like one of those paintings by Bruegel which Ted loved, and as he walked downhill, he could feel himself becoming an unexpected yet essential detail. Man holding avocado, in torn shirt and grubby slacks. His presence was as appropriate as the people breathing fire, or juggling, or running in a circle half naked. Regardless of realms of being, all and sundry were turned toward a rapturous, if uncertain, center. "Hello, friend," someone said. "Hello," Ted answered, and then hello again, and again, until he started offering up his own greeting without cue. Like, this was the first day of school, and every one of his hellos was met with equal enthusiasm, a great big sloppy welcome. He could hear Carol muttering something about the smell and what these people were smoking, and could you somehow be affected as well, because she had heard stories, and in this day and age you had to hold tight to reason, and if need be, rely on tranquilizers for a decent night's sleep. And Ted, please stop saying hello. Much of the pleasure of being here was walking with his specter of his wife, defining himself in opposition to her attitude. "Hello!" "Shh!" Halfway around the circle, Ted noticed something. Someone. A flash of the familiar among the unfamiliar. The woman had no name. Only a shape that slotted within Clinton Elementary. The child in her arm, the youngest of three boys, a mirror to his own three girls, who fit between them like rungs on a ladder. He had seen her at the school before, and though they had never exchanged words, he remembered a particular slyness that seemed to set her apart from the other mothers, a tilt of the head that sized up the world, a divot of suspicion across her brow. Ted stared at her in the hope of becoming visible, as if she alone had the ability to see him, and when that failed, he went over and said hello. "Hi," she said back. No, I know you," he said. "Or, I mean, I know you without knowing you. I mean, well, sorry, let me begin again. I think we have children at the same school." The polite veil lifted and her eyes sharpened, the sudden focus almost pulling Ted forward. "Oh, that's right," she said, smiling with tactile consequences. Her front teeth were somewhat bucked, which only added to her overall abundance. "You have girls," she said, "and you have boys. Almost the same age, almost the same age." They practically sang this like a lyric. "And here's my youngest," she said. "Bobby, say hi." "Hi, mister." "Martin," Ted said. "Ted Martin." "Emma Brady." The thought of shaking hands passed between them, their indecision almost blush-worthy until too much time had elapsed and the introductions fell to their feet. "Quite a circus," Ted said. "Bobby and I were just..." Emma was explaining when Bobby interrupted. "There are like four guys on stilts," he said, "and a monkey, too." "Yeah, I was at the Dodger game." "Really?" from Bobby. "Uh-huh." "They'd win?"
Still going on, but losing when I...
They stink.
They sure do, Ted said, wishing he had a son who might settle him, might confirm his role as a father, instead of as a punchline for the girls, and you'll never understand and let me handle this from Carol, his non-member status essential for their exclusive club, the clueless dad, the hopeless husband. The woman in his life assumed his eternal collaboration, never as the star, but as the supporting player. None of them realizing how quickly this could change, how suddenly he could step forward, if pushed even slightly.
Well, who was pitching for the Dodgers?
Alan Foster.
Who?
Exactly. They both left, man to boy. Ted Martin, Emma repeated to herself, because she was bad with names and had been told repetition helped. Ted Martin, who had a wife who was blonde and pretty, but with a ridiculous hairdo, more like a silken shower cap, and who wore these elaborately knotted scarves. Ted Martin, her husband, the man who sat by her side during those school plays and recitals, those all-parent functions, his leg often tapping and his wife stilling him with a touch and a grin that was more public apology. Ted Martin, his attention shifting from the stage and toward the rafters, as if spotting something up there. Ted Martin, Emma christened in retrospect. The golden husband with the golden wife and the golden daughters, the golden couple of Clinton Elementary of Studio City, and how he had once caught her looking up as well, hoping to see whatever circled overhead. Ted Martin, here in Elysian Park, laughing with her son, striking a pitcher's pose, a small green ball in his hand. They sorely miss Koufax, he said.
What's that? Bobby asked, pointing toward his hand.
An avocado, and not a particularly good one. But it's late in the season, and all the trees around here have been pretty well scavenged. Did you know there were avocado trees here? A lot of them. All kinds of fruit trees. It used to be something I did with my dad. Ted Martin flipped the avocado to himself. Hey, if I threw this, you think you could catch it, Willie Mays? Bobby nodded. You sure?
Yep.
Because I'm going to toss it high, like above the trees high. Bobby backed up, giddy at this adult challenge. And you better catch it. I don't want a bruise on this piece of free fruit.
But not too high, Bobby said.
Okay, not too high, Ted agreed. You sure you're ready? Bobby nodded again. On the count of three, then. One. In preparation, Ted Martin cranked his arm back, his torso angled toward the sky, and Emma smiled at the obvious exaggeration. You sure you're ready now? The full meter of his name having sunk in. Two. Better not drop it, kid. So that every breath seemed to scan him, seemed to rise and fall over the architecture of a Ted Martin home. You sure you're ready? Emma noticing the split seam on his shirt along the left shoulder, the skin beneath a streak of sun. Three. After that day in the park, Ted Martin and Emma Brady each resumed their regularly scheduled existence as father and mother, husband and wife. Though there were moments that still interrupted, all very innocent, like that easy toss in the game of catch. The dog that stole the avocado in the ensuing chase, a total of 30 minutes spent together before the clock turned toward the deeper meaning of an hour, and they both came to the same conclusion, that they should go. It was getting late. So goodbye. And maybe see you around school. Once back at home and reestablished in their routine, they found their moods tightening, their ears sick of the everyday complaints, their mouths barely able to answer the everyday questions, neither fully understanding the repercussions of this chance meeting, those glimpses from Elysian Park which seemed to confirm their fate. They were trapped. It was one of those small things that could breed a tremendous amount of discontent. But soon the groove sank into the larger rut of days and weeks and months, the memory losing its attraction, its melodramatic possibility, and shifting instead to the silly fantasy of a schoolyard crush on a fellow parent. My goodness, as absurd as those hippies on stilts. By the time the Cardinals beat the Red Sox in the World Series, Ted Martin and Emma Brady had mostly forgotten one another, and what endured was resignation. This is my life, and it is a perfectly fine life.
Thanksgiving was on November 23rd that year. Emma Brady was going to Cincinnati the Monday before so that she could help her overwhelmed parents get ready for the onslaught of family. The new live-in housekeeper would handle the boys and cook their meals until the three of them flew east on the 22nd with their father. When Mike heard this plan, he gave Emma his patented look, blue eyes narrowing as though her faulty logic were blinding, as though his gift to the world were reason, practically in his hands, right here, Emma, reason, take it. But Emma no longer cared about these looks, having negotiated her own terms from the above resignation, like hiring a live-in housekeeper and going to Cincinnati early and alone. I really wish we were going together, Mike said as he pulled up to the curb of departures. Makes so much more sense. Your parents have done Thanksgiving before. They can cook a turkey. I'll call when I get to their house, Emma said. And you're missing Pete being a pilgrim, a minor pilgrim, but a pilgrim. He's disappointed. We all are. Mike seemed to tick these points from the roof of his mouth as if he maintained a list up there, his tongue the enumerating finger. It's not too late, he said. Emma was barely listening. Instead, she was imagining Ted Martin in the audience at the school play, sitting with his wife. His daughters probably Indian princesses, their hair the promise of native maize. Ted Martin reformed in her mind. Ted Martin, sharper than before. I should check in, Emma said, opening the car door. I can help with your bag. You should go. A jester brought a sky cap. I'll call. I don't like this, Mike said. I don't like being separated like this. I really think you should stay. His habit of always trying to win an argument, even when there was no argument to win, softened, and his eyes reverted to a warmer memory of South Sea waters and a honeymoon that got Emma pregnant before she truly understood the meaning of sex. I'll see you soon. Emma leaned back into the car and kissed him on the cheek. TWA Flight 128 en route to Boston, Massachusetts, with stops in Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, was departing at 5:37 p.m. from Gate 39. Ted Martin was behind schedule. A combination of bad traffic and his propensity for misgauging time, his internal clock always optimistic, as if he were the hero destined to arrive before the countdown reached zero. His wife hated this quality. Carol insisted on being early, waiting and checking her watch, her punctuality a lit fuse. But Carol was home, getting dinner ready for 6 p.m. sharp, while Ted was heading to Boston for a meeting on Tuesday. It was a job that no one else had wanted, since it was so close to Thanksgiving. But Ted enjoyed traveling, in particular flying. As a boy, he would go to the Burbank Airport with his dad and watch the Douglas DC-3s take to the air. Still amazes me, his father would say. Every time they lift up, seems like a small miracle. So Ted had volunteered for the mission and was now rushing through the terminal with only 5 minutes to spare, the flight boarding on the tarmac. He weaved between people and warned them by way of preemptive apology, his smile natural and broad, like the juice chalking up another touchdown for USC. When he got to Gate 39, he flashed his ticket at the attendant, and she practically cheered him on through, "Go, Ted Martin, go!" And he maintained his speed right up the stairs, stepping into the cabin and half expecting the passengers to greet him with applause. The plane was a Convair 880 and had 75 passengers, with another 7 in crew. Of course, nobody on board was aware of the particular story of the sudden change in personal dynamics when Ted Martin and Emma Brady locked eyes, of the absolute recalibration of the world within that confined space. They both startled without moving, Ted in the aisle, Emma in her seat. What had been forgotten now came speeding back, Elysium Park on that beautiful fall day, the drums, the dancing. Ted was the first to smile. "Hi," he said. "Hi," she said back. "Going to Boston?" "Cincinnati." Before anything else could be said, the stewardess prompted Ted to his seat. 3 rows separated them, and as the cabin crew went through the safety procedures, Ted and Emma seemed to experience every version of possible danger. the turbulence, the sudden loss of oxygen, even the remote possibility of a water landing. Ted could glimpse the back of Emma's head, a shag cut, different from the bouffant of 7 weeks ago, while Emma could feel the force of Ted's green-gray eyes peering from behind, like sea glass, she recalled from that day in the park, a surprising piece of treasure. Tray tables were raised, smoking materials extinguished, and they both thought, "We are alone." The airplane rose over Los Angeles and then headed east. The lowering sun like its counterweight, a reminder of what was being left behind, and in its place the lift and flow of what lay ahead. After the plane reached a cruising altitude of 25,000 feet, the fastened seatbelt and no smoking signs dimmed, and Ted rose without internal debate. He solicited all the powers of his charm and asked the older woman sitting next to Emma if she might possibly change seats with him so that he could talk with his friend, and, God bless her, she agreed, with an almost expectant smile, as if she had been reverently waiting for this request. "Thank you so much," Ted said, settling her into 9B. "Enjoy the flight," she told him. And here they were, after 7 weeks. 7 weeks of leaving behind that day in Elysian Park, not even a day but 30 minutes. Almost 2 days passing for every minute they had spent together. A minuscule percentage, and even less when measured against the length of a marriage. "Good to see you again," Ted said. "You too," Emma said. "I like your hair." "Really? No one else does." "Well, I do." "Thanks," she said. "I needed a change, you know, even if it's silly." And this was the beginning. Over Nevada they flew, over Utah and Colorado, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. The distance gained bringing them closer together, as they both had screwdrivers and white wine with their chicken fricassee. Then more drinks. The two of them talking about their lives without ever mentioning spouses or children, their lives before they became what they became, as if up here they could begin again. Begin again as the same people in different lives, in Paris, in New York, in London. And they smiled and seemed to recognize themselves in the other's reflection. This attraction between strangers slowly growing into a passion between co-conspirators who could blow up the world in order to start another. What seemed impossible alone, together seemed possible. "Maybe I should stay in Cincinnati," Ted said. "I'll be with my parents," Emma said. "Well, I'm due in Boston." "So?" "We both could get delayed, make our phone calls, head to the nearest hotel." Ted had never been so bold, Emma so accommodating. "A hotel," she said, head tilting. "Yes." "The two of us," she said, "in a hotel?" "We can be Mr. and Mrs. Smith," Ted leaned in closer. "Since I met you, you've been a pulse in my head. It's like we are meant to be, like we're connected, you know, like the universe is insisting on us being together. Maybe that sounds silly as your haircut." "And our families?" Emma asked. That was the first mention of them. "Truth is, I see only two people here," Ted said. These words, they seemed scripted. And here we are again, back to the beginning, which is the end. All the passengers have buckled their seatbelts. The plane is on its final approach to runway 18 of the Greater Cincinnati Airport. Light snow is visible through the windows. As the landing gear lowers, Ted Martin reaches for Emma Brady's hand. This is their first touch of skin. We know from transcripts that the pilot and co-pilot reported no issues from the cockpit. All temperatures set and cross-checked on 07. Yaw damper check. All is good. Ted squeezes Emma a bit harder, his thumb rubbing her thumb. They both hate landings. At 8:57 p.m., the airplane clips a few tree branches at an elevation of 875 feet, approximately 9,357 feet short of the runway. After several more impacts with trees and finally the ground, TWA Flight 128 comes to rest 6,878 feet from the runway. There, it bursts into flames. The people in the few nearby houses hear nothing unusual, though minutes later they will hear the sirens and then imagine having heard a boom taking possession of the disaster. As the airplane tumbled, Ted Martin and Emma Brady both flashed on their respective families, onto Marcia, Jan, and Cindy, onto Greg, Peter, and Bobby, onto Carol, onto Mike. A single all-encompassing thought that contained a world within a world where the two of them were forever missing. But that quickly passed. For now, in this world, they were alone, staring at each other, almost calm. Their unforgotten hearts gripped by the fall. From the voice recorder, we know the captain's final words. "Come on, you," he said, trying to strain his arms into wings. The next story is from the November 25th, 2019 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Invention of Thanksgiving, Massacres, Myths, and the Making of the Great November Holiday, by Philip. Autumn is the season for Native America. There are the cool nights and warm days of Indian summer, and the genial query, what's Indian about this weather? More wearisome is the annual fight over the legacy of Christopher Columbus, a bold explorer dear to Italian-American communities, but someone who brought to this continent forms of slavery that would devastate indigenous populations for centuries. Football season is in full swing, and the team in the nation's capital revels each week in a racist performance passed off as just good fun. As baseball season closes, one prays that Atlanta, or even semi-involved Cleveland, will not advance to the World Series. Next up is Halloween, typically featuring Native American brave and sexy Indian princess costumes. November brings Native American Heritage Month and tracks a smooth countdown to Thanksgiving. In the elementary school curriculum, the holiday traditionally meant a pageant with students in construction paper headdresses and pilgrim hats reenacting the original celebration. If today's teachers aim for less pageantry and a slightly more complicated history, many students still complete an American education unsure about the place of Native people in the nation's past or in the present. Cap the season off with Thanksgiving, a turkey dinner, and a fable of interracial harmony. Is it any wonder that by the time the holiday arrives, a lot of American Indian people are thankful that autumn is nearly over? Americans have been celebrating Thanksgiving for nearly four centuries, commemorating that solemn dinner in November 1621. We know the story well, or we think we do. Adorned in funny hats, large belt buckles, and clunky black shoes, the pilgrims of Plymouth gave thanks to God for his blessings demonstrated by the survival of their fragile settlement. The local Indians, supporting characters who generously pulled the pilgrims through the first winter and taught them how to plant corn, joined the feast with gifts of venison. A good time was had by all, before things quietly took their natural course. The American colonies expanded, the Indians gave up their lands and faded from history, and the germ of collective governance found in the Mayflower Compact blossomed into American democracy. Almost none of this is true. As David Silverman points out in This Land is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving, published by Bloomsbury. The first Thanksgiving was not a Thanksgiving in pilgrim terms, but a rejoicing. An actual giving of thanks required fasting and quiet contemplation. A rejoicing featured feasting, drinking, militia drills, target practice, and contests of strength and speed. It was a party, not a prayer, and was full of people shooting at things. The Indians were Wampanoags, led by Osamuquin, often called Massasoit, which was a leadership title rather than a name. An experienced diplomat, he was engaged in a challenging game of regional geopolitics, of which the pilgrims were only a part. While the celebrants might have well have feasted on wild turkey, the local diet also included fish, eels, shellfish, and Wampanoag dish called Nasaump, which the pilgrims had adopted, boiled cornmeal mixed with vegetables and meats. There were no potatoes, and indigenous South American food not yet introduced into the global food system, and no pies, because there was no butter, wheat, flour, or sugar. Nor did the pilgrims extend a warm invitation to their Indian neighbors. Rather, the Wampanoags showed up unbidden. And it was not simply four or five of them at that table, as we often imagine. Osamaquin, the Massasoit, arrived with perhaps 90 men, more than the entire population of Plymouth. Wampanoag tradition suggests that the group was in fact an army, honoring a mutual defense pact negotiated the previous spring. They came not to enjoy a multicultural feast, but to aid the pilgrims. Hearing repeated gunfire, they assumed that the settlers were under attack. After a long moment of suspicion, the pilgrims misread almost everything that Indians did as potential aggression. The two peoples recognized one another, in some uneasy way, and spent the next 3 days together. No centuries-long continuity emerged from that 1621 meetup. New Englanders certainly celebrated Thanksgivings, often in both fall and spring, but they were of the fasting and prayer variety. Notable examples took place in 1637 and 1676, following bloody victories over native people. To mark the second occasion, the Plymouth men mounted the head of Osamequin's son, Pumatakam, above their town on a pike, where it remained for 2 decades, while his dismembered and unburied body decomposed. The less brutal holiday that we celebrate today took shape 2 centuries later as an effort to entrench an imagined American community. In 1841, the Reverend Alexander Young explicitly linked 3 things, the 1621 rejoicing, the tradition of autumnal harvest festivals, and the name Thanksgiving. He did so in a 4-line throwaway gesture and a 1-line footnote. Of such half-thoughts is history made. A couple of decades later, Sarah Josepha Hale, the editor of Godey's Ladies' Book, proposed a day of unity and remembrance to counter the trauma of the Civil War, and in 1863, Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday of November to be that national holiday. Following Young's lead in calling it Thanksgiving. After the Civil War, Thanksgiving developed rituals, food ways, and themes of families and national reunion. Only later would it consolidate its narrative around a harmonious pilgrim Wampanoag feast. Fretting over late 19th and early 20th century immigration, American mythmakers discovered that the pilgrims and New England as a whole were perfectly cast as national founders, white, Protestant, democratic, and blessed with an American character centered on family work, individualism, freedom, and faith. In the story that many generations of Americans grew up hearing, there were no Wampanoags until the pilgrims encountered them. If Thanksgiving has had no continuous existence across the centuries, however, the Wampanoag people have. Today, they make up 2 federally recognized tribes, the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead, and they descend from a confederation of groups that stretched across large areas of Massachusetts, including Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. In the years before the Pilgrims' landing, trails and roads connected dozens of Wampanoag communities with gathering sites, hunting and fishing areas, and agricultural plots. North America's defining indigenous agriculture, the symbiotic 3 sisters of corn, beans, and squash, came late to the region, adopted perhaps 200 years before Europeans appeared. That's when the Wampanoags, who moved seasonally between coastal summer residents, not unlike Cape Cod today, and protected winter homes inland, they took up farming. Cultivation and cropping created a need for shared use land management and an indigenous notion of property. That led in turn to the consolidation of a system of sachems, leaders who navigated the internal needs of their communities, established tributary and protectorate relationships with nearby communities, and negotiated diplomatic relations with outsiders. When the pilgrims encountered Osamequin, They were meeting a paramount sachem, a Massasoit, who commanded the respect necessary to establish strategy for other groups in the region. To the west, the Narragansetts, traditional rivals largely untouched by epidemics, now outnumbered the Wampanoags, and that led to the strengthening of Assamequin's alliances with the surviving Massachusetts and another nearby group, the Nipmucks. And so, after much debate, he decided to tolerate the rather pathetic pilgrims who had seen half their number die in their first winter, and establish an alliance with them. That history, understood through Wampanoag characters and motives, explains the rejoicing that Americans later remembered as a pumpkin-spiced tale of Thanksgiving conciliation. Silverman provides a vivid account of the ways the English repaid their new allies. The settlers pressed hard to acquire Indian land through sales driven by debt, threat, alliance, politics, and violence. They denied the co-equal civil and criminal jurisdiction of the alliance, charging Indians under English law and sentencing them to unpayable fines, imprisonments, even executions. By 1670, the immigrant population had ballooned to 60 or 70,000 in southern New England, twice the number of native people. American Indian is a political identity, not a racial one, constituted by formal, still living treaties with the United States government and a long series of legal decisions. Native American tribal governments are actively resisting efforts to dismember the past, demanding better and truer Indian histories and an accounting of the obligations that issue from them. At the forefront of that effort, you'll find the Mashpee Wampanoags, those resilient folks whose ancestors came uninvited to the first Thanksgiving, almost four centuries ago, in order to honor the obligations established in a mutual defense agreement, a treaty they had made with the Pilgrims of Plymouth. The previous article was edited for length. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you very much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. I'm Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.